from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Charles Darwin is famous for theories including natural selection and survival of the fittest. He's less known for the inventive experiments he ran with the help of his family at home, which helped inform Darwin's groundbreaking book On the Origin of Species.
So many of the interesting arguments in that book were based on these curious experiments that Darwin was conducting, often literally in his backyard.
Author and biologist James Costa captures a different side to Darwin in his new book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. He'll join us in studio, coming up next, after this. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his book, Darwin's Backyard, biologist James Costa provides new details into the life and work of the scientist known for his theory of evolution and natural selection. Many aspects of Darwin's research are well known, his voyage on the HMS Beagle to study wildlife in the Galapagos, for example. But Costa reveals a Darwin who enlisted his family to help run experiments on everything from potatoes to earthworms, and he joins me here in studio this hour to talk about life in Darwin's country home and how to recreate his backyard experiments. Welcome, Jim Costa.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you. I was saying, what are the takeaways from this book, other than the fact it was delightful to read and fun, and I know it must have been to write, too, but Darwin was really literally curious about everything and enlisted everyone to help him, and his home was his laboratory.
Yeah, he had an expansive curiosity, and, you know, I was really struck by the contrast between that aspect of his personality, his penchant for these fun experiments that involved his family, and, you know, the sort of public iconic image that he's known for today, you know, kind of a staid and serious, you know, maybe sometimes even melancholy character. I thought, wow, there's such a contrast there, and I wanted people to better understand the flesh and blood Darwin.
No, this is the original kind of crowdsourcing. I mean, you know, it wasn't only his family that got involved in these experiments.
True.
You know, you had the local vicar, the governess, the schoolmaster. I mean, everybody he could get.
Yeah, and even publishing open letters in magazines, you know, asking readers to try experiments, send in the results. You know, some of them are mentioned in The Origin of Species even.
Well, there's also so many. I mean, he was moving through a pretty big place we're talking about here, Downhouse, which is in Kent. I mean, gardens, wetlands, meadows. And he took advantage of the environment of his home. But, you know, you look through the list, experiments with bees, with pigeons. There were, what, how many varieties of pigeons?
Oh, gosh. I think he must have kept at least six or eight at various times. And there are, of course, many more. I mean, pigeons became this nice, you know, almost like the lab rat, you know, version of, you know, understanding how artificial selection can modify species.
I think he bred and raised about 16 varieties. That was, I think, the number I got from your book, at least. But also worked with climbing plants, with orchids, even to the point in the Victorian era of having orchids described as sexually reproducing, which shocked a lot of people. So all of these barnacles, I mean, the list is just extraordinary.
Oh, it just goes on and on. And really, he was a lifelong, as he would have called it, experimentizer. You know, he loved experimentizing. And depending on, you know, his interest at the time, he had research interests that varied over time. He would throw himself into, you know, ferreting out information about these different questions he had about the natural world. And it's curious, you know, after his epic voyage around the world, he never really much left home again. You know, there were family holidays to the seaside and that kind of thing, but no big journeys. And so, yeah, you know, literally in his yard, in the meadows, in his own greenhouses, in the woodlands, not far from his home, he conducted these experiments and really figured out an awful lot about the natural world just right there at home.
Just from your own backyard. And it's old-fashioned kind of natural philosopher, which is really what he was, as you point out. But, I mean, some of these experiments, like, let me just give an example here, tossing an iguana out to sea over and over and over again, see if it would come back to the same spot.
Well, when he was on the Beagle voyage, I mean, you do see, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, you see some indication of this penchant for conducting, you know, on the fly, quote unquote, experiments, you know, and sometimes they are a bit odd, a bit quirky. And the iguana episode in the Galapagos Islands was one, you know, I guess it was debated whether these were really truly marine iguanas and well, just how comfortable are they in the sea and how well do they swim? And so what better way to find out? Just keep throwing one in and see what it does. You know?
This was called, I mean, before he got to evolution, and this all really led him to the theory of evolution in many ways, it was called transmutation?
Transmutation in his day, yeah.
Yeah. So there was at least a gleaning of it, but what he was able to perform in the way of these experiments, I mean, was able to not only create a bulwark for evolutionary theory, but really design the whole nature of evolutionary theory, yeah?
Yeah, his experiments really shaped, there was a feedback, I suppose, you know, between theory and the empirical data, but his experiments really shaped the direction that his thinking went. He, you know, became convinced of the reality of evolution, or as he would have called it, transmutation, about, you know, 6 months or so after getting home from the Beagle voyage. And then he set out to really ferret out as much evidence as he could over many years in seemingly, you know, strange and unrelated areas, whether it was seed dispersal or plant pollinator relationships or aspects of the structure of barnacles and those sorts of things. Each one can seem like an oddity, but really it's all of a piece. It's all of a piece for a grand kind of overarching argument that he wants to make.
We're talking with Jim Costa. He's director of Highlands Biological Station, professor of biology at Western Carolina University, and the author of Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. And he'll be delivering the Darwin Day Lecture at the Valley Life Sciences Building, UC Berkeley, tomorrow at 12:30. That's sponsored by the Department of Integrative Biology. And we're talking about Darwin this hour, and we'll bring our listeners into this discussion with any questions and comments you might have about Darwin. But the fact is that many of these experiments people can do in their own backyard. That's kind of the fun of your book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was early on struck by just how accessible they were. And, you know, in his day, in this kind of experimentizing, if you will, it was really done on the fly, you know, at home, you know, in a, you know, MacGyver-like way, you know, to kind of invoke that, you know, the TV character who had to solve these various problems with, you know, just whatever materials were at hand. And it occurred to me that, boy, you know, anyone could do this now. You can replicate his experiments just with using, you know, ordinary household objects at hand and kind of, you know, follow in his footsteps in that way and gain some, you know, understanding by looking a little bit more closely at different aspects of nature.
Yeah, and the book gives you the means to do this with your kids and all the rest of that. Of course, when you think about Charles Darwin, the tragedy of losing children, and, you know, in fact, I think the loss of his 10-year-old daughter was what turned him probably into an atheist, but he couldn't bring that out in his theories because his wife was such a strong believer, really.
Yeah, there's some debate over whether, in fact, Darwin was an out-and-out atheist. You know, he's famously kind of reticent to really discuss those things, but certainly, even by his own admission, I mean, the death of his daughter, Annie, he and Emma were profoundly affected by that. And I think she was much more religious than he. Emma, I think, sought solace in her belief. He could not. You know, he couldn't square the loss of this child with the idea of a very personal and benevolent deity. So that did drive him further away from orthodox religious belief in any case.
Yeah, he lost three children. And
all told, yes.
All told, yeah. I mean, it's just unthinkable. But maintain this almost relentless curiosity and continue these experiments. Let's talk more about some of these experiments. I mean, you got a nice plug on your book from one of my heroes, E.O. Wilson, Ed Wilson, and Darwin also worked with ants, yeah.
Oh, he did. He was keen on ant behavior, well, in a number of ways. You know, in The Origin of Species, he discusses the problem of sterile castes, for example, in social insects like ants, and considering that a special difficulty. But he was also interested, when it comes to behavior, in what was called slave-making ants. These are ant species that are, in some cases, obligate parasites. They produce workers that cannot really care for the colony themselves. They raid the nests of other species, and they take the young larvae.
Actually, talked about them with Ed Wilson on the air here.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
wonderful.
Did, yeah.
And he was fascinated by that. You know, he was interested in these certain extreme obligate forms of parasitism like that and like you see in cuckoo birds, and was interested in tracing out an evolutionary pathway. That's why he was observing ants and following them around in the field and trying to better understand their behavior.
Well, as you said, there's just this whole list of different animals and different fauna life of one sort or another, but also the flora, I mean, and geology too. I mean, let's talk about that because Darwin's doing this in his backyard as well.
Yeah, you know, and I guess it's often, you know, not fully appreciated that Darwin actually considered himself to be a geologist before really becoming what we would call a biologist. You know, his early love was really geology. When he traveled around the world on the Beagle, he was very consciously trying to make geological observations and, you know, sort of styled himself as a kind of disciple of the great Charles Lyell, you know, the great dean of geology in Britain at the time. And his first several books, in fact, included geological volumes. He had three books on geology just in the 1840s. And very early on, he became interested, really through an idea that was given to him by his father-in-law about the action of earthworms as a geological force, the idea that humble little earthworms could really remake the landscape. And it's very kind of classic Lyellian, what we today might call uniformitarian, slow, steady, incremental changes to the landscape. That was a lifelong interest. One of his first experiments was to set out rocks in a field to document how the earthworms would undermine them and they would slowly sink over time. And it actually was the subject that he returned to much later in the 1870s, did a whole series of investigations, and it was the subject of his very last book.
We're talking again with Jim Costa. He has a book out on Darwin, and I'd like to hear from you, our listeners, if you have questions about Darwin or something you'd like to bring to the conversation. We indeed would like you to join our conversation. Any questions or comments, let me tell you how you can bring them forth. Our toll-free number is available. That number to call is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program, so please feel free to join us. Again, the number 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Maybe you can talk a little bit, Jim, about an experiment, maybe a simple, easy experiment that people can do at home where it would be educational not only for them but perhaps for their progeny.
Oh, certainly. Well, there's lots of fun possibilities. One of my favorites really has to do with a replication of an odd one that Darwin performed. I call it his duck feet experiment. Darwin used actual duck feet. We don't have to do that today. He was interested in the question of whether ducks could disperse aquatic organisms like snails. He was imagining lakes and ponds as islands on the land. He's interested in how these aquatic snails get from pond to pond because they can't survive very long outside of water. And he fancied that they may climb aboard ducks' feet as the ducks are resting or sleeping, you know, in a pond, and then take off the next morning with hitchhikers, you know. And so his version of the experiment involved, you know, dangling ducks' feet in an aquarium with snails. And to his satisfaction, was able to document that, yes, indeed, you know, snails will climb on board. And then he would remove them from the water and time how long the snails would hang on and that sort of thing. I have a
version. And we learn what from that specifically?
Well, we learn that that ducks can serve as vectors, right, transporting aquatic snails from lake to lake, pond to pond, you know, that these snails that couldn't otherwise really get around, they can get dispersed very effectively over hundreds and hundreds of miles through the action of hitchhiking, really, on ducks. And Darwin wanted to generate some data to support that contention. And so my version of that involves sort of fishing with model duck feet, which can be easily made with a little bobber and a dowel and a fabric, you know, kind of cut out duck foot on a drop line. And you can kind of cast that into a pond, for example, let it bob around for a while, reel it in. And it's remarkable, actually, how many organisms often end up on that little model duck foot. And you can kind of demonstrate to your own satisfaction, you know, ducks really can carry lots of things around from lake to lake.
So go to your local duck pond, take some snails, and you'll be in for the experiment. Yeah. That is, provided you don't have a pond in your own backyard with ducks or something along those lines. Didn't Darwin's father say to him he wouldn't amount to anything?
He did. Yeah, the irony was Darwin was, at one time anyway, something of a disappointment to his dad. And by his own admission, you know, he was... he wasn't very academic. He really despised the very formal and rigid academic curriculum. He loved nothing more than to be out, you know, in nature, riding his horses, running with his dogs, hunting, shooting. His dad at one time did say, you're going to be a disgrace to yourself and all your family, you know.
Well, he did a lot of other things around that place of his downhouse. I mean, some of the stories you tell about chasing bees and you were mentioning earthworms before, serenading earthworms?
And serenading earthworms, yeah. Yet another interest in worms. You know, he became interested in what very seemingly very simple animals can teach us. And he was convinced that the abilities, even the cognitive abilities, the mental attributes of very complex animals, even us, had their origins in very simple, humble animals. And so he fancied that that the humble earthworm had proclivities, had sense perception. At one point, he sort of conducted a little impromptu orchestra. His wife was playing piano. One of his sons was playing bassoon. His little grandson was on the penny whistle. And they were testing the hearing of earthworms, whether they would respond to music. And of course, you know, they don't hear per se, but they do respond to vibration.
Yeah, the vibrations. Yeah. Well, we respond to callers. Let me bring some of them aboard here. And we start, great, Marjorie, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Hi, I've been listening to you talk, and I had a question because in my class today, yesterday, we were talking about social Darwinism, and I wanted to know if that's actually something that Darwin had thoughts about, or if it's just totally other people's assumptions.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. What we call social Darwinism today is something of a kind of a co-optation of, you know, basic ideas about evolutionary principles.
Only the strong survive.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And then co-opted and kind of applied in a social and political context. Darwin, I think it's fair to say, would be appalled really at some of the things that have been said and done in his name under this banner of so-called social Darwinism.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Marjorie. There is certainly a lot of talk about social Darwinism, and it continues to be both inveighed against as well as promoted. It reminds me, when you were talking about Darwin being perhaps shocked at what's been done with social Darwinism, it reminds me of what's been done with Nietzsche, you know, and the Superman, kind of similar in some ways, at least in my head. Let me bring another caller on, and that's Anthony. He's joining us this morning from San Jose. Anthony, you're on. Good morning.
I always heard that, not along the words of the social aspect of it, but that Darwin believed that the British were, at that time, more evolved than the Italians. Is that true?
I can't speak to whether that specifically is true. I mean, there is no question that Darwin, as a man of his time, was
something. It's a question coming from a man named Anthony.
Right. I'm of Italian American, you know, ancestry myself. But there's certainly a cultural chauvinism, a kind of built in at that time that Darwin would have had no question in his mind about the superiority of certain cultures and societies over others.
And the reality is, I'm a lit guy, and I have always been struck by how much the British write about, A.M. Forster comes quickly to mind, about the Italians being, you know, more expressive, more warm, more outgoing, and more emotional. And they see that cultural difference in those ways because, you know, Brits identify more with stiff upper lip and keeping your emotions at bay and all the rest of that. So that may have been part of at least what Darwin was seeing, don't you think?
Well, certainly was aware of you know, profound cultural differences, whether it is expressiveness or other attributes, and you know, but then whether to sort of draw a line from that to the idea of some of these tendencies being innate, what we would call genetic. Of course, in Darwin's day, you know, genetics had, as a field, had not been founded. Mendel's laws had not been, you know, rediscovered. But innate somehow, heritable. I'm not sure that he would have that he bought that idea, but there was no question that he did understand and appreciate profound cultural differences and was interested in something that we would perhaps call cultural evolution. You know, just the way that we transmit information by learning, by communicating. Very different form of transmission from the biological mode of transmission of information.
A lot of these experiments you write about, Jim, didn't he call them fool's experiments?
He did. Darwin certainly has a sense of humor, and he can be self-deprecating. He would comment on, these were larks. These were, he would just, on the fly try these things out. He called them his fool's experiments. But then he commented how he loved fool's experiments. You know, almost uniquely, I think, among naturalists of his time, he was given to trying these just to see what you could learn. And it's remarkable, not just how many of these experiments provided information that made it into his book On the Origin of Species, but also how they set his whole research agenda after that book after book. I mean, half a dozen alone on different botanical subjects were all built upon these experiments.
And we mentioned how he enlisted just about everybody he could, but that included many of the local naturalists. I mean, there were a number of them around him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, although Darwin, became something of a homebody, and he was not much of a traveler after getting home, and especially after his marriage, started a family, he and Emma moved to Downhouse, really reluctant to travel. And yet, he was at the very center of a worldwide network of naturalists. His correspondence is voluminous. I mean, there are many, many volumes now of his published correspondence. And he was constantly being visited by friends and family. And so often, whoever happened to be visiting at any one time, they would get dragged into the experiments.
So where did, for example, I was reading some of these experiments, like he would decide he's going to tempt fish to eat seed.
Yes.
Now you wonder, where does somebody conceive of that idea of, let's see if I can tempt these fish to eat seed?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that connects back to that question about dispersal. You know, when you see species distributed as they are on Earth, the geographical distribution, it just begs the question, well, how do they get there? How do these species get, for example, to remote oceanic islands? Or how does an aquatic organism get from this lake to that lake? And logically, you would think they must be carried somehow, or, maybe birds on the wing can carry seeds and, they get blown off course, that sort of thing. But there were no data.
It just begins with a basic question, like I thought.
Just a basic question.
Yeah. And something is ignited. Well, we'll continue with our guests. We're talking to Jim Costa, director of Highlands Biological Station, professor of biology at Western Carolina, and author of Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Jim Costa. He is director of Highlands Biological Station and professor of biology at Western Carolina University and author of a new book called Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. And it includes do-it-yourself experiments. And he'll be appearing tomorrow, 12:30 p.m., in the Valley Life Sciences Building at UC Berkeley. And we do welcome your involvement. If you want to talk about Darwin or talk about Darwin's experiments or theory of evolution or natural selection or any of all that, please feel free to join us here. And just thinking, a question from a listener named Robert. Let me go to this because many people may want to know. If you can help us here, Jim, can you recommend one or two contemporary books on human evolution that are accessible to interested laypersons?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'm a fan of Ian Tattersall's books on human evolution. There's a huge field of such books, and it's hard to pick out just one or
hundreds
two.
Hundreds of books of Darwin come out every year still,
oh,
don't
gosh,
they?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah.
You've got a lot of competition, but this is the first book that I know of, and I was very involved in a Darwin symposium back in 2009 when I was part of a big science humanities program led by the late Michael Gregory, who I remember very fondly, a Darwinian. The whole notion was that I don't think people knew about all these experiments he was doing. I mean, you brought them out to the public eye here.
Yeah, it's a little known side of Darwin. Again, it's curious. I've been struck by how, well, it's maybe the downside of becoming an icon, right? Icons tend to become one-dimensional. And we also often know Darwin through his portraits. You know, that's what comes down to us from the Victorian period. And
like you say, they're very staid and sober looking.
Exactly, though, yeah. And yet, you know, so I'm interested in intellectual history. I'm interested in the people behind ideas, the human beings. And inevitably, that leads you, if you start delving into Darwin, to really appreciate his sense of humor, his warmth, his friendships, his family life. You know, I really came to appreciate Darwin, the guy, you know, the dad, the husband, the friend, with this, you know, insatiable curiosity and creativity, you know, this penchant for experimentizing. Often, just on a lark, you know, to try things out, and sometimes a practical jokester.
Well, we're going to go to our callers, but Gary wants to know, what was the source of Darwin's money? Did he have an income from books or research?
Well, he did have an income, but he actually came from very well-off families, both on his mother's side and his father's side. His mother was a Wedgwood, so his maternal grandfather was Josiah Wedgwood, the first founder of the great Wedgwood pottery manufactory.
And his paternal grandfather was Erasmus, right?
Yes, was Erasmus Darwin, a famous physician, perhaps even more famous poet in his day, a best-selling poet, and Erasmus. Much could be said about Erasmus.
A friend of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, in fact. Right?
Yeah. Coleridge and the Romantics really admired Erasmus greatly. In fact, you know, the word Darwinism or Darwinizing was was coined by Coleridge to describe Erasmus Darwin. You know, he was sort of given to these wild flights of speculation about things. You know, and again, another character with insatiable curiosity, and Coleridge was struck by that. And you know, when he would spout off some wild theory about something or other, you can just sort of hear Coleridge saying, "Well, there he is, sort of Darwinizing again." You know.
Well, you know, aside from the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, probably Coleridge is best known for suspension of disbelief, that notion that you can read something like Kafka's The Metamorphosis, a guy turns into a dung beetle or whatever, and you suspend your disbelief and you just go along with it, you know, for the ride, so to speak. Let me just read a comment of Carl's. For those interested in Darwin as a geologist, you should check out the new book, Darwin's First Theory, by Robert Wesson. Along with evolution, he studied earthquakes and their contributions to land movement.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a polymath of all polymaths, really, when we talk of Darwin, and we'll get more calls on. Let's go to Berkeley. Berkeley, do I have your name right?
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having the show. It's fascinating and great topic. Two quick questions. Okay. So my first question was, his family, I think, did a lot of research, not just him. And I was wondering, you know, did synesthesia run in his family? I heard a rumor or I read something, you know, like his brother had it or was studying it. And was his brother involved in the experiments or did Darwin ever do any experiments in that area of synesthesia? I know it was probably not well believed back then, but I know now we know it's a fact. And then the other question was, hybrid vigor. Did that come from, is that a theory that Darwin had, and did he do any experiments in his backyard relating to that? And how can that inform, you know, like human hybrid vigor? Like, to teach us today, like, well, you know, being diverse and marrying a diverse person or having kids with different racial backgrounds might be healthier than, you know, as, than like, you know, back in Darwin's time, I'm sure they knew, like, if the royal family was in breeding all the time, you know.
Yeah, both good questions, Berkeley. Let's take synesthesia first. When I'm coming up on a 25-year anniversary. One of the first programs I did on Forum was on synesthesia. Do we know it was Darwin's synesthesia?
It's unclear.
Studied it?
Did not study it. You know, it's very unclear, you know, various conditions or maladies. He was something of a hypochondriac, perhaps. I mean, he was constantly worried about, you know, aspects of his health.
We should define synesthesia, probably. I mean, you know, it's when you see different colors attached to whatever. You know, you actually are seeing things in a kind of technicolor way, and
right,
attach
in a
colors
very different,
to different
way.
Objects.
Yeah, yeah. And he was very much interested in you know, quote unquote abnormalities, aspects of his health, that of his children, unusual attributes. I think because he was consciously aware that, you know, his wife was his first cousin, as was not unusual in his day. I don't know that there's any evidence that he was, you know, synesthesiac, or that any of his family exhibited the trait.
Do you know about him and hybrid vigor?
Well, there, you know, of course, heredity was something that people were very slowly groping towards at that time. And, you know, in reading Darwin's chapter on hybridism and the origin of species, you can see him describing, I mean, breeders understood what we call hybrid vigor as an empirical observation when you're crossing, you know, two different breeds, did not understand it in the way that we do, except that he realized the importance of mixing things up genetically, and that, you know, by crossing different breeds or different varieties, this was a way to mix things up. So he did observe what we would call hybrid vigor, didn't quite understand what he was looking at, though.
Again, our guest is Jim Costa. Let me go to more of our callers. And Baron, thank you for waiting. You're on the air with us. Welcome.
Morning, Michael. And Jim Costa, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate this this topic. I'm a high school teacher, a high school history teacher in particular, and I'm prepping a history of science class for this upcoming year. And so one thing I was wondering was, you know, Jim, did your research simply serve to humanize Darwin, or did it lead to any further developments on better contextualizing or differentiating Darwin, like within the context of, like, his contemporary natural philosophers? You know, I have in mind, like, Lamarck with his transformism and others. And the other thought I had was, you know, given this upcoming class, is there a particular portion of your book that you think a young historian of science should read and take lessons from?
Well, thanks for those questions. To answer your second one first, I think maybe the introductory chapter that really kind of sets out the origins of, you know, this guy's penchant for experimentizing and kind of looking at Darwin in the context of his family life, his curiosity, what he did when he, you know, embarked upon this voyage around the world on HMS Beagle. That first chapter that sets the tone of the whole book might be the one that your students might really enjoy as an entree.
And thank you for the call, Baron. Good to hear from you. We'll go right to another caller in Gilroy. That's Donnie. Donnie, welcome. You're on Forum.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, hear you fine.
So let me just preface by saying I typically don't use songs as references for historical facts, but I don't know if you're aware, there's a band called Artichoke. They did a song about Charles Darwin, and they mentioned that he had this lifelong affliction of something like Chagas disease.
Mm.
And I was just wondering if there's any evidence, specific evidence for that.
I'm familiar with Artichoke's great song, actually. Among other, you know, sort of medical maladies of Darwin's, it is debated, you know, what is the source of this this condition that he had? I mean, he was really racked with illness after the Beagle voyage throughout his life. And, you know, sometimes he could be something of a hypochondriac. Other times, I mean, it was really manifested in you know, very vividly. You know, he was flatulent. He was, you know, just constantly indisposed. But it's really unclear what the source of that may have been. He thought that he might have inherited some, you know, sort of weakness. Some have speculated that he was bitten by an assassin bug in South America and contracted Chagas' disease, and this can lead to a chronic condition. even dyspepsia. But really, these are debated, and I think almost every year there are papers published on, you know, kind of a new hypothesis about explaining Darwin's afflictions. It's really just not known.
Let me thank the caller and remind you that you have an opportunity to join this program with any questions or comments, any thoughts about Darwin. We do welcome you as part of the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Joanne writes, there's a lot about this gentleman in your book. She says, it's been said that some of Darwin's work was built upon the work of Alexander von Humboldt. I'd be interested in your guest observation.
Ah, the great Humboldt. You know, Darwin certainly idolized Humboldt when he was younger, when he was a college student. You know, he would read Humboldt. And I think like many young aspiring naturalists of his generation, Humboldt was, you know, was this sort of demigod of travel. You know, when Humboldt traveled in South America the late 1790s into the early 1800s, exploring landscapes, then publishing this very vivid prose about his explorations and discoveries, truly inspired a whole generation, including Darwin. In fact, Darwin, you know, he had tried to hatch a plan to travel in Humboldt's footsteps and go to the Canary Islands with some buddies of his in college. You know, he really longed to go to the tropics and behold the sights that Humboldt had so vividly described. That project ultimately fell through. But ultimately, he was able to realize this dream of visiting the tropics. And his letters home often would reference Humboldt and how excited he was to be following in his footsteps.
Well, Humboldt deserves a lot of credit, really, too, doesn't he, for evolutionary theory?
Well, I wouldn't say evolution per se. You know, Humboldt, I think we honor rightly as a kind of a visionary, maybe a founder of the environmental movement. Really understanding in a very holistic way the natural world, what we would call ecology, really. Humboldt was very much a pioneer. But in the process, he did pioneer some techniques that Darwin made use of, one that was called at the time botanical arithmetic, this kind of, you know, trying to quantify, you know, numbers of species and genera and other groups and look at ratios between different types of habitat or high elevation, low elevation, you know, high latitude, low latitude, and really trying to better understand the patterns of the distribution of species on Earth.
John wants to know about, he says Darwin is famous for his study of emotions in animals and man. Did he make experiments at home involving the emotions?
Oh, absolutely. And an interesting episode that Darwin called his studies into the natural history of babies. And here he would make careful observations of the behavior of his newborn children. And, you know, he really wants to understand, you know, what aspects of our behavior are innate and how does that relate to our closest relatives, other primates. And so he would make careful observations. He would even do some things that probably, you know, annoyed his wife some. Like he would at one point startle one of the kids really to observe them crying and wanted to observe which facial muscles were involved in you know, just really a serious, you know, meltdown, you know, by the baby. And she wasn't too amused by that. But these experiments were much later published and some of them did make it into his book on the expression of the emotions in man and animals.
You talk a little bit about what he did with climbing plants. That's kind of fascinating.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, Darwin, you know, again, just to give context, I mean, in terms of the overarching vision of the unity of all of life, he's convinced that plants and animals are fundamentally related. They have a common ancestry, as we would say today. And therefore, he's interested in any evidence he can find of animal-like qualities of plants, as well as plant-like qualities of certain animals. And when it came to climbing plants, and also, by the way, carnivorous plants, these to him seemed the most animal-like of plants, you know, just their uncanny ability in the case of climbing plants to move, to seemingly sense and respond to their immediate environment, often very quickly. You know, how do they seek out a support? On what basis do they have a touch perception and begin to ascend, to climb and wind around supports, almost snake-like as they sort of, you know, move around? And so he was interested in documenting that. And in the process, he made some fundamental discoveries. For example, a term that is used by botanists today called circumnutation, which is the constant circular searching motion of growing tendrils and shoots, seems to be an adaptation and an elaboration of a very natural tendency of virtually all growing shoots to move very slowly in these circular ways. That seems to be exaggerated in these climbing plants as an adaptation. He was fascinated by that.
Again, our guest is Jim Costa. His book is Darwin's Backyard. And here are some more callers. Let's go next to you. Glenn, you're on the air.
Hi. So you mentioned the term Darwinist, and I'm wondering, is that a precise definition about what isn't a Darwinist? Mm-hmm. But my real question was, a while ago, I saw a picture, a drawing of a line of horses up through the modern horse, and the description and the view of, I think, English people of, this is the pinnacle of horse evolution. And in fact, you know, they wrote about it, well, that's actually a dead end because it's a really not very practical animal. Did that sort of idea come from Darwin about a pinnacle aspect, or was that someone else later? Thanks.
No. Yeah, thanks for that question. Well, no, that kind of imagery or iconography about evolution in a very ladder-like or linear manner really came about after Darwin. That's very, very emblematic of a kind of early 20th century depiction of evolution. And it's actually an interesting and a bit of a complex topic that we don't have time to get into here, but it has to do with a kind of revival of an earlier idea about evolution, that of Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck in France, which does tend to be a kind of linear evolutionary model. And so that iconography is certainly considered to be very much of the time, you know, the kind of branching and rebranching pattern of evolution that we understand today is actually much closer to Darwin's conception of the way evolution worked.
Thank you, Glenn, for that call. Good to hear from you. Let me hear from another listener, and that's Mike in Mill Valley. Mike, join us.
Yeah, hi. I think a lot of people don't know about Wallace and his great contribution. He could have, I believe, scooped Darwin because he was working independently, came up with all the results for adaptation through natural selection, and out of deference held out publishing his evidence. In fact, sent it all to Darwin. And I think that's what finally got Darwin off his duck to publish what he'd sat on for decades. And I don't think a lot of people realize in this day and age, it's hard to imagine, you know, with the competition of getting to the press first, what a gentleman Wallace was.
Oh, Wallace is an amazing human being in many ways, and I must agree. I mean, effectively, he did scoop Darwin, and we can thank Wallace for really, you know, being the the immediate kind of kick in the pants that Darwin needed to finally go public with his ideas. Wallace was, you know, remarkably generous, magnanimous individual who always deferred to Darwin. I have a book that I published in 2014 on Wallace, Darwin, and the Origin of Species, where I try to examine their relationship, which is complex in some ways, and also try to address some concerns that some people have expressed over the years that maybe somehow he was treated poorly or that Darwin acted somehow dishonestly. I must say, I'll give away one of the punchlines of that book, which is that I see no evidence of that. But I really try in that book to give Wallace his due. I ultimately make the argument that these are two giants who together should be honored as co-founders of this important field.
And let me thank Mike for the call. Remind you, we're talking to Jim Costa, and he's the author of Darwin's Backyard. He'll be delivering the Darwin Day Lecture at the Valley Life Sciences Building at UC Berkeley tomorrow at 12:30. The event is open to the public. And Mary writes, Darwin did think that men were more evolved than women. He had a small feud with a suffragette in New York who thought his initial work indicated that all humans were equally evolved.
Well, yeah, Darwin in some ways was certainly of his time. He's something of a cultural chauvinist and something of a male chauvinist. And he had sort of no question in his mind that that the sexes were well adapted in a sense for different things. And inevitably, I mean, it's very hard to separate, you know, being deeply steeped in this kind of cultural tradition of, you know, the way we look at and gender and sex roles and those sorts of things, as well as cross-culturally, you know, those biases. So now whether he would have used that term kind of more evolved, he would sometimes make notes to himself to stop thinking in terms of higher and lower, you know, but inevitably, I think he would sometimes slip into that language. I don't know that he would have used that phrase more evolved per se, but he might have understood very different sets of adaptations of men and women.
Well, like you said, he was a man of his time. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
Male chauvinism was, shall we say, was the order of the day.
Absolutely.
Let's get Brandon on next. Brandon, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hey, Michael. Big fan. Jim, thank you for this conversation.
My pleasure.
My question is just in thinking about the church, specifically the Catholic Church, but Christianity as a whole's reaction to, you know, controversial publications over the history of, you know, throughout history. What was the, was Darwin scrutinized by the church at all after his findings were published in, you know, in contrast to creationism or no? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. Well, Darwin, I mean, he feared a real firestorm of controversy, something that he, you know.
From his wife as well.
His wife. He knew that his wife and other relatives were, you know, certainly were devout. He, you know, that firestorm never did materialize. And it's interesting, in the day, I mean, the clergy of his day, you know, there were about as many arguing in support of Darwin as there were arguing against Darwin. And I think that, you know, where you fell out along that spectrum might have to do with just how the degree of orthodoxy or just how what the divine agency might be. I think then as now, it's possible to kind of reconcile a conception of a creator, let's say, that operates through natural laws. If you look at the epigraphs of The Origin of Species, the little quotes that Darwin selects there are really speaking to exactly that. And the whole question is, to what extent do we have active divine agency versus to what extent do we have natural law reigning supreme? And he leaves unanswered, really, the open question. Of course, it begs the question, well, where do the natural laws come from? Those of more religious persuasion would say, well, certainly, you know, the great author of nature, the creator, God, is responsible for the natural laws. And on the other end of the spectrum might be, you know, overtly materialistic people that would deny, you know, that kind of agency.
Here's Dale who says, can you talk about the culture at this time when men like Darwin used their personal fortunes to do scientific research and found organizations to publish their work? It seems to me that society really benefited from this ideal versus how our 1% use their time today.
Well, I wonder how that compares. There were probably a fair number of people of means, even in his day, that didn't necessarily use their wealth in ways that we might consider to be constructive. But true enough, that was the time before the professionalization of science, when much of science was done by wealthy individuals, that people that had the means, that had the leisure time to devote themselves to their studies and would support them. Increasingly, as the 19th century wore on, the idea of science as an institution, even sometimes co-opted in a kind of, you know, as part of the imperial project in Britain, you know, that was garnering government support more and more, and scientific institutions that we're accustomed to today, you know, laboratories, universities dedicated to research, was coming increasingly onto the scene. So Darwin is considered by some historians to be the last of the great what they call country house naturalists, you know, wealthy individuals supporting their own scientific research right there in their home-built laboratories.
And a question from Kit. He says, don't ducks or migratory waterfowl also facilitate virus evolution by carrying their virus load to places where it mixes with, for example, swine viruses, thus potentially permitting reassortment evolution into new virus forms?
Oh, sure. I mean, any kind of movement, right, gene flow in modern parlance, you know, moving organisms around and bringing them into novel environments or in proximity with other organisms that they're capable of interacting with in some kind, absolutely is facilitating the evolutionary process.
What are you going to say at your talk tomorrow? Because it's open to the public.
It is open to the public. Well, my talk will be based on the book. I wanted to introduce the audience to this side of Darwin that we've been discussing. You know, Darwin, as I like to
Darwin
think,
at
Darwin
home.
The guy, Darwin at home, yeah. Darwin the dad, you know, Darwin the husband, Darwin the friend, you know, try to kind of, you know, put a spotlight on his penchant for these curious experiments and why, you know, what is the big picture there? What was he so interested in? And what did he learn? You know, those are the sorts of things I'll be exploring tomorrow.
What do you most admire about Darwin, you personally?
Oh, gosh. That's a tough one. That's a good question, Michael. I admire this combination of profound insight and creativity, insight into the natural world, combined with a real humility. You know, this is an individual who... There's very little ill that you can say about Darwin. I mean, he was just, you know, a nice guy.
He was a kind man.
He was a very kind man. And, you know, to combine, you know, looking at his achievements and then understanding the humility behind it, I think is really, you know, remarkable.
Well, it helped to have a father who said you're not going to amount to much. I suppose to keep you humble. Jim Costa, good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Oh, great pleasure. Thanks so much, Michael.
Jim Costa's book, again, is Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. And 12:30 tomorrow in the Valley Life Sciences Building at UC Berkeley, you can meet him and hear his talk about Darwin. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and hope that you will let us know if there's anything you want us to know by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. We'll be back with you on the morrow. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.